Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. It's become an annual tradition in the last few years, and it's firmly up for debate whether it's a good tradition or not, the supposed war on Christmas. And this year, it's resulted in two proposed Merry Christmas bills in the Oklahoma legislature that would, quote, allow, unquote, teachers to say Merry Christmas or Happy Hanukkah. And more constitutionally problematic, to celebrate Christmas and allow nativity scenes and religious symbols into the classroom. But there's a deeper issue involved, and it's how do we account and accommodate a more religiously pluralistic society, which is constitutionally protected, in a culture that has been and remains Christian-centric? Well, my guest today reminds us that America remains a deeply Christian-based society in so many ways, some trivial, like the fact that weekends are based on the mainstream Christian Sabbath, to more serious effects, like foreign affairs and dealing with Islamic nations and how we historically have treated religious minorities in our country. Paul Kivel is a social justice advocate, author of the acclaimed book Uprooting Racism. He's the director of the Christian Hegemony Project, and his latest book is titled Living in the Shadow of the Cross, Understanding and Resisting the Power and Privilege of Christian Hegemony. It's published by New Society, and he joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Paul Kivel, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
I've heard of the term Christian hegemony before, but most of the time it's for really very conservative Christian groups that are actually insisting on more Christian control of culture. It's interesting from reading your book, Living in the Shadow of the Cross, when you speak of Christian hegemony, you are speaking of sort of the underlying Christian values that permeate American society. Tell us a little bit about what you mean by Christian hegemony.
I think the definition I would use would be the everyday, pervasive, and systematic set of Christian values and beliefs, individuals and institutions that dominate all aspects of our society through the social, political, economic, and cultural power that they wield. You know, hegemony is a word that means dominance, but when we think of dominance, we think of it as external force, you know, the police, the military, the government. Hegemony means a system that's been so long-standing and so deeply entrenched in a society that it's become invisible. It's just become part of the way things are. And so I wanted to keep that deeper level. And I think I need to make it clear that I'm not talking about individual Christians here, and individual Christians have a wide variety of beliefs, nor am I really talking about Christianity per se, because, again, there's a lot of different kinds of Christianities and alternative Christianities, but over the centuries, there's been the accumulation of power and wealth in Christian institutions and a common set of key concepts that have come to dominate our society. And it's that issue of dominance that I'm really trying to focus on.
Well, there are probably positive aspects of that dominance, and there are probably negative aspects of that dominance.
Well, I mean, I think, again, of course, individual Christians have done lots of good things, and Christian churches have done, you know, a lot of charitable work and things like that. But when you get a system that dominates, it creates a certain homogenization of people's thinking. It produces a marginalization of various groups that are not Christian or not considered Christian enough. And it has tend to inform our public policy and foreign policy in sometimes very destructive ways. So, for instance, a key concept within dominant Christianity is that humans were given dominion over the earth. And, of course, that has been used to justify unlimited exploitation and devastation of the natural environment. And another level it operates at is the concept of manifest destiny and the ability of the United States as an exceptional country to go overseas and declare war and try to shape people's beliefs and cultures. And that's used to justify endless war against evil.
Well, I was interested you mentioned manifest destiny because I read that section of the book, and I guess I'm failing to see the Christian roots in that, because it seems to me it's more of an imperialistic state rather than a religious backdrop to manifest destiny.
Well, there's two aspects that are very specifically religious. One is that the popes in the 15th century gave a mandate to Christian rulers to go out and basically conquer any land that wasn't already controlled by other Christian rulers, and to enslave the people and take the land and to convert them to Christianity. And this was the mandate that Columbus and Cortez and Pizarro and Cabot and all the explorers were under the belief that they had a divine right to go out and take any land that wasn't, you know, in the hands of Christians. Manifest destiny, really the root of that is the belief that God has blessed the United States in a special way to be a role model to the rest of the world. And our responsibility is to go out and bring Christianity and civilization. These days it's called free market capitalism and democracy. But it's that sense that we have this divinely blessed and exceptional role in the world.
And so the fact that we've moved to free market capitalism, democracy, as opposed to spreading Christianity, doesn't make it any less Christian in your view?
Well, it's the impulse behind it, that we have a special divine purpose and responsibility and exceptional role, and therefore we're above international law, for instance. We don't have to abide by human rights standards and things like that. Just a couple months ago, Obama, in front of the United States, reiterated that the United States is an exceptional country, and what he meant by that is that we are not ruled by the same considerations of human rights and things that other countries are. So it's been used to justify what is, you know, economic exploitation and is war and militarism, under the guise that somehow it's okay when we do it because we're on the side of good in the cosmic battle between good and evil.
Well, in your book, you sort of talk about the symbols of everyday American life that have some sort of Christian formation. It's really surprising because a lot of the things that people take for the granted, from the one day of the weekend that is considered the day of rest, if you were a Christian, you would say the Sabbath, but in other cultures, it may be Friday or Saturday. It's Sunday here because that is a Christian viewpoint. Can you maybe talk about some of the ways in which, and a lot of them readily see the Christian influence, others not so clearly?
Correct. We're right now in the middle of a holiday season that is loaded with Christian dates and Christian holidays and Christian meanings, starting with Thanksgiving, going through New Year's. And the way it dominates our society, the expectation that everybody should be on board with celebrating this. Of course, a lot of different cultures have different New Year's. It's really a Christian New Year because it's dated from the birth of Jesus, and history is divided into two periods, one before his birth and one afterwards. So New Year's is definitely revolves around the Christian calendar, of course, Christmas as well. So that's one very visible manifestation. You know, if you look on our currency, there's the phrase, "In God we trust." And, of course, that doesn't refer to Allah or Yemayah or the Great Spirit. It refers to the Christian God. And it was put there to emphasize that we were a Christian nation. The Pledge of Allegiance and One Nation Under God was added specifically to indicate we were a Christian nation via the godless atheist communists. So there's manifestations, almost every place you look, there's indications of how pervasive this is. But it's important in my book, what I tried to do is to step back and see what's the total picture. How do these things add up? How do they influence the way we think? How do they influence our public policy? And how do we challenge that? How do we begin to open the space up for different ways of thinking and being in the world?
Well, how does that influence our public policy?
Well, certainly our environmental policy is clearly, it's been very difficult to gain traction for taking seriously the destruction of the natural environment because of the sense that humans do have dominion over it. It's ours to do what we want with, and that the earth itself isn't inherently sacred. God and heaven are sacred, but the earth is not seen as sacred. So,
may I stop you there for a second? Because I know there are plenty of Christian sects that would say that in fact is our duty to ensure that our earth is as clean as possible and that we don't have dominion over that. So there's actually divide within Christian opinion.
Of course, but some of that is moving from a sense of dominion to stewardship, and it still is coming from a very human-centered place that we have the ultimate say. And so it's really hard to get to a concept of interdependence with the natural world and mutual balance and respect for the earth and for the animals and plant life that lives on it. And so of course, Christians have a lot of different relationships to environmental issues and environmental justice movements, but the dominant thinking in our society and played out in our public policy arena is that we get to make the decisions, and we can ignore the fact that we're interdependent with the world. We can see lots of evidence in the healthcare system, the lack of availability of contraception and abortion throughout the country, the attacks on reproductive rights for women. This indicates the influence of Christian institutions and Christian wealth. The resistance to full civil rights for gay and lesbian people is another indication of how Christian dominance shows up in our public policy.
But it's interesting, in all those cases, there's a divide within the Christian community, and there's Christians working on behalf of both positions.
Right. Although if you look at, like, the issue of gay rights or reproductive rights, it's not just that Christians have different positions, but very well-funded and influential and powerful Christian organizations like the Catholic Church, the Mormon Church, the Southern Baptists, the Episcopalians are putting huge amounts of resources into determining those policies. And then we have a lot of parachurch organizations focused on the family, Prison Fellowship, Campus Crusade for Christ, thousands of parachurch nonprofit organizations that are also pushing these kinds of agendas. So it's true that individual Christians have a lot of different opinions and have different relationships to these things, but there is a dominant pattern in our society of funding and supporting certain kinds of ideas and certain kinds of access to full inclusion in our society.
My guest today is Paul Kivel, a social justice activist and director of the Christian Hegemony Project. His book is titled Living in the Shadow of the Cross, Understanding and Resisting the Power and Privilege of Christian Hegemony. It's published by New Society. One of the things you do is you look at the underlying ethical moral underpinnings of our society and the fact that it is very much shaped by Christian thought and theology, everything from duality that shapes a lot of our governmental thought to a lot of places. And I wanted to ask you if you could sort of expand on the idea of duality in Christian thought and how that expands beyond church boundaries into everyday life.
The main thing that happened within dominant Christianity over the centuries was that the fundamental duality, that everything is either good or bad, became defined very early on as a cosmic battle between good and evil. And, of course, our political leaders have very often used that to say, you're either with us or against us. And this was the battle cry of the Bush administration in declaring a war against evil, or against an axis of evil. And so you may have disagreements with people, but once you label them bad or evil on the other side of the cosmic battle, then the stakes become very high. And if everything is either associated with God or the devil, heaven or hell, then it's very easy to go to a very aggressive level. For instance, a country that has differences with us, that we have disagreements with, once we label them part of the evil network, then compromise and negotiation are no longer on the table, because you don't negotiate with evil. The only response to evil is aggression. And even in interpersonal relationships, we often very quickly go from somebody was my friend, but they do something wrong, so now they're bad and they're beyond the pale, so to speak. It's not a framework which promotes compromise and negotiation.
Isn't that just sort of a cornerstone of politics in order to mobilize public opinion? Because nuance, shades of gray, ambivalence doesn't motivate anybody.
Well, it is definitely used that way. You know, for instance, most people in the United States are not in favor of going to war overseas, of sending our young people to fight in whether it's Southeast Asia or the Middle East. But as soon as our political leaders name this war as a war against everything bad in the world, the evil communists or evil terrorists or evil this, then public opinion shifts very quickly to supporting those kinds of wars. They're seen to be justified. So, yes, it's easily exploitable, and it's really important that we look at where does that come from, how much do we buy in personally to this dualism, this dividing everything, this belief that there is this cosmic battle going on.
Well, you know, and it also takes into account, you know, there is morality, and it could be other religions' moralities, but the moralities tend to have at their core sort of a central, all religions have that sort of central core of do unto others. And, you know, I think a lot of these adventures overseas, there is a moral component, whether it's Christian or whatever other religion you might observe, when one group is slaughtering another, say, in World War II. I don't know if the label is evil or not, but it needs to be stopped. And you use the example of the former Yugoslavia, where the Americans went in to bomb Serbia after the breakup of Yugoslavia because there were ongoing ethnic disputes and ethnic cleansing going on against a variety of cultures.
Right, and there's, you know, situations come up, you have to make moral decisions, or as a country, as a nation, you have to make decisions about whether to intervene or not, or how to intervene, and you know, how to keep the cost down in terms of human life and suffering. But what I'm saying is that within the framework that we have, within this dominant Christian framework of a cosmic battle between good and evil in a fundamental dualism, it very quickly escalates into much greater levels of violence. It very quickly pushes other alternatives off the table, and we end up feeling like almost any amount of aggression that we participate in is justified because we're on the side of good. If we're on the side of good, anything we do is okay. If they're on the side of bad, anything they do is not okay, and we can do anything we want to them. So it's this framework just pushes us constantly towards a more aggressive place in the world, either interpersonally or internationally.
So what in your mind are the steps that we can do to reduce the hegemony that's a part of our framework for our society?
There's been a long history of people who have resisted Christian dominance. Some of them have been Christian, who have stood up against the Crusades or the Inquisitions or the Nazi Holocaust or war and slavery here in our own country. There's also constantly been groups that have created alternative Christianities that have tried to, you know, reclaim different values, different core values coming from the New Testament. So part of the resistance has always been from within Christianity. And then, of course, there's been a long resistance of those outside who have struggled for not just survival, but autonomy and sovereignty and separation of church and state and, you know, full inclusion and human rights for everybody in the country, not just those who are, you know, deemed legitimate or on the good side. Your question is the important one, and the first is we have to understand how this system works. We have to not think that it's just those people on the far right who are those Christians. That's kind of like saying, if we just talk about the KKK or the neo-Nazis, we don't have to look at racism in our own communities. We have to not just say, well, it's those extreme dominionist Christians that are the problem, and the rest of us are doing okay. So once we understand that, then we can look around in our organizations, our neighborhoods, our communities, and start talking with others, looking at where does Christian dominance show up, and how can we organize with others to challenge it, to build sustainable and healthy communities in ways that are not based on some of these concepts that lead to so much destructiveness, whether it's environmental destructiveness or international destructiveness or destructiveness in our own communities.
I think I can hear a lot of people taking issue with the fact that these political decisions, you put it in the course of a Christian framework, because those who do believe in the separation of church and state, and there are many, would say that that has no place. Can you maybe amplify that Christian idea that's at the heart of a lot of politics, of geopolitics, of social issues in our country?
I think a good place to start is with that phrase, the separation of church and state. It's not religion and state. The founders definitely had an assumption that this would be a generally Christian society, but they didn't want any one Christian denomination to have power over anybody else. But we can look at the tremendous levels of Islamophobia that we experienced in this country in recent years. The attacks on mosques, the arson, the hate crimes, as an example of the way that those who are not Christian are easily marginalized and vulnerable to violence. And the attack, the hate crimes and attacks on gay and lesbian and bisexual and transgender folks, as well as ways that this worldview, that Christianity holds the one truth, that it is always right and good, and that Christians have a divine sanction to be able to dominate everybody else in the society.
That's the heart of religious pluralism, the fact that there are many different religions in this country, and we're becoming increasingly successful in allowing the free practice of those different faiths.
And definitely that's part of the resistance, as people have been challenging that on many different levels. But we still see such a tremendous accumulation of power and wealth in the denominations and the parachurch organizations that it's not just a question of individuals standing together. It's actually about challenging the accumulation of institutional power that continues to play such a huge role in our public life.
My guest today is Paul Kibble, a social justice activist. He's director of the Christian Hegemony Project and author of Living in the Shadow of the Cross, Understanding and Resisting the Power and Privilege of Christian Hegemony. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I want to sort of shift focuses, because this book outlines the many ways from, I think I read an account recently where there's a university where people are encouraged to remove their hat in one particular building as a sign of respect, and it honors war dead at a particular university. Well, if you're Jewish, Sikh, or Muslim, you believe your sign of respect is keeping your head covered at all times. And that gives you a sense of some of the, you know, it can be trivial, not so trivial ways in which Christian hegemony is a part of our society. But I want to talk about this other side of it, which is that Christianity, there's a belief in a subculture that Christianity is under assault, and it always comes up during this particular time, the assault on Christmas or the war on Christmas. I was wondering what your thoughts are about that.
I think that, you know, when women started demanding equal rights and equal opportunities in the society, one of the responses from some men was to say that, oh, you're attacking our rights, that we're actually the victims here. You're taking away things that we've had, privileges that we've come to accept. And it wasn't that men were actually being victimized. Women weren't trying to dominate men. They were just trying to say, we want a fair chance and equal opportunity. And I think a lot of that happens today when people name and describe Christian dominance, and even try to make small inroads into creating a more pluralist, religiously plural society. Christians are very quick to cry, we're the martyrs here, we're under attack, we're being victimized. And if you think about this holiday season, it's a good example. I mean, the dominance of Christian symbols and music and TVs and movies and everything is so overwhelming that if we change our language to invite people to a holiday party rather than a Christmas party, it just is such a small thing. And yet that's what some Christians are saying, well, we're under attack. It's an understandable but really small-minded response to people saying, we really need to shift things because things are so unequal, and we want to move towards equality rather than continue to move towards dominance.
And I find it a fascinating story, because so many of the symbols which they refer to as Christian are all polytheistic, animist.
Right,
in
it's background, very ironic.
From the holiday itself, which was a solstice holiday, to symbols like the Christmas tree, which was a pagan symbol of fertility.
Right, and part of the way that Christianity built dominance over the centuries was to build churches on sacred sites and to declare its holidays on top of pagan or other people's holidays, and to really colonize and appropriate other people's and close out the space for religious pluralism. So it's very ironic that now they're saying that these are holy, you know, and untouchable kinds of things.
One question I had as I was reading through the book was that, you know, you're talking about the United States as being this Christian dominant culture, and it certainly is, But if you live in Israel, it is a Jewish-dominant culture. If you live in many parts of the Middle East or Southeast Asia, it is a Muslim-dominant culture. If you live in India, depending on where you live in India, it's either Muslim or Hindu-dominated culture. And that's just sort of the way it is.
Whenever a religion becomes dominant in a way that it controls the political process and accumulates the wealth and power, it's a problem for those who are not of that faith, and even for many who are. But there are many societies that are religiously plural and are not, so acutely exploitative or marginalizing of those who aren't the main faith in the country. It's not inevitable. I wrote the book Living in the Shadow of the Cross because we are living here in the United States, and this is the system that we have to deal with. And if you're in a different country that has a dominant religion, you would want to pay a lot of attention to how does that work and how do we undermine that dominance. It's not exclusively to Christianity. It's not universal, but we're here, and this is what we have to work with.
Well, what are the first steps for those who are thinking about this? Maybe they're Christian in background. What are some of the first steps they should start thinking about and seeing the influence of their religion or of, I use the broader term of Christianity than religion. I mean, it's really a whole social construct.
Well, I wrote my book as a one way for folks who want to learn more and go deeper. I also have a website, christianhegemony.org, which has a lot of resources, articles, exercises, links, and things like that. I think the first thing is to really, it's like having a new lens to see the world through. For many of us who are white, when racism was first brought to our attention and we started looking around, we began to notice much more deeply how racism operated around us, in our organizations, in our schools, etc. And having a hegemonic Christian lens is a new tool to use to look around, to notice where this is happening, how it works. And so that's, I think, the first step. And then having conversations with folks, noticing with other people how things are going, and how does it show up in your workplace or in your school or university or in your neighborhood? Beginning to say, that this is uncomfortable. This is marginalizing of some people. This is exclusive. This is leading us to public policies that are destroying the environment or that are leading to endless wars in the Middle East, more crusades. So it's a steady several-step process of going from the understanding to the action to get to the point where we can really begin to undermine more thoroughly and in an ongoing way some of the most destructive aspects of Christian dominance.
Paul Kivel, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been good to talk to you.
Paul Kivel is a longtime social justice advocate, the author of Uprooting Racism, and his latest book is titled Living in the Shadow of the Cross, Understanding and Resisting the Power and Privilege of Christian Hegemony. It's published by New Society. Well, at Studio Tulsa, our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. And we thank you for listening. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for joining us.